Welcome to the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science Research Podcast Series at the University of Nottingham, Ningbo, China, the first Sino-foreign university. I'm Dr. Mary Jane Ainsley, Associate Professor in International Communications.
And I'm Dr. Derek Irwin, Associate Professor of Applied Linguistics. We're coming to you from the Language and Pedagogy Laboratory here at the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences.
For this edition of the series, we are delighted to be joined by a very special guest to UNNC, Dr. Xiaoliang Yang.
Xiaoliang is an assistant professor at Zhongnan University of Economics and Law, and he specializes in researching macroeconomics and public economics. Xiaoliang's academic interests lie in the fields of inequality, taxation, and discrimination, and he's published a number of collaborative articles across the field of economics.
In 2024, together with collaborators Lucy Barras, Kent Matthews, and David Minag, Xiaoliang published the article "The Dynamics of Redistribution, Inequality, and Growth Across China's Regions" in the Journal of Policy Modeling. Okay, Derek. So I particularly enjoyed this one because I found this topic actually quite relevant to my own experience here in China.
So, really? So you've had taxation inequality rising in your life?
Thank you, Derek. Anyway, because if I can continue.
Please continue.
Thank you. I'm just realizing how ridiculous that sounds.
Should we back up slightly? Sorry.
No, we shall not. We shall
Excellent.
Continue. We shall all right. move forward because this is what this is all about.
Okay. Can I jump in though?
No, because... I'm finishing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
All right. Thank you. What I was going to say was that I found this very interesting and pertinent to my own experience because having been in China now for quite a few years, I feel like I have witnessed an enormous amount of change just within my tiny little bubble, ultimately.
Okay. That makes perfect sense.
And this kind of article in that way was sort of about that, in the extent to which China has changed, about how its policy has changed, about how the country has changed, and about how things like wealth distribution has also changed. So I found this to be very interesting, and it actually introduced me to some of the mechanisms that I feel made that change that I've observed.
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, it's really
fascinating. So are you now eating your words?
Absolutely not. No, I'm still going to mock you whenever I get the chance.
All right, Ian, fair enough.
But I found it really fascinating to see a model by which we can explain how various regions in China have managed the systems of a kind of taxation and redistribution. And overall, just the incredible success story between a kind of growth and equity, which is, I've always said it's been fascinating. I've been coming to China for over 25 years now. Mm-hmm. And here on the East Coast, you've seen enormous growth. But also, how does that relate to the rest of China, which
is a
really interesting question.
Indeed. And that sort of focus on the inequality between regions and within regions, I felt was very relevant to this. Because sort of you go outside, I feel, not just the East, but also kind of Zhejiang in particular as sort of one of the most prosperous and one of the wealthiest regions in China. And you go outside that and things are often very, very different in many ways, you know, culturally, economically, and all sort of the rest of it. So I did enjoy this article because it really did introduce me to the actual mechanics behind all of this and just how actually complex the division between things like taxation on both a national and a regional level actually are. I don't think we appreciate those so much, I think. And certainly being from a country like the UK, which is, of course, much smaller than China, and which has very different models, I think, people don't quite understand the differences, I feel, between kind of a smaller country like the European countries and then the sort of vastness of China and the amount of people that are here. Because I know you, of course, being from Canada, are also from a very vast country, shall we say. But the
vast
population.
And empty, though.
Indeed. That was my point. The population makes things very different in that way.
So welcome, Xiaoliang, to join us here. We were fascinated by the article. Maybe for our listeners, you can explain the basic thesis of what you were exploring here, and then we can get into some more detailed questions that we had when we were reading through it.
Thank you very much, Darren. Thank you, Mary. It's a great honor to be here to share my recent paper published. And actually, this paper, just now, Merritt mentioned that people care about the inequality. As inequality is one of the hottest topic in economics now, since the Piketty's successful book, 21st Capitalism. Mm. But actually, if you look back to the history on this topic, we can trace back to the Kuznets 1951 or even earlier. So in this paper, we focused on the regional inequality instead of personal individual inequality. So that means we look at the regional development in a vast country, like you said, in China. So the situation is quite different from the UK. Yes, in China, we have a big country, we have a big government, central government. So the central government has a stronger power to intervene the local government's behaviors. So
now, sorry, just to interrupt, by local government, there are various levels, right?
Yeah, so many levels.
You can just explain to people because it is complicated.
Yeah, we just focus on the state government or the provincial government. Yes. So just the two levels, the top level is a central government and the second level is a provincial government.
By provincial, you mean, for instance, like the Zhejiang government?
Yes, like the Zhejiang government, but not the Ningbo or Hangzhou government.
Okay.
Yes.
And I think this is sort of almost jumping in. This is one of the things that's quite amazing. The Zhejiang population, what is it now? I think it's upwards of about 50 or 60 million.
Yeah, 60
for instance,
million.
It's huge.
60 million.
Right. Yeah, that's incredible. That's absolutely incredible. So when we say regional, all right.
Provincial, I mean, that's greater than the population of our country.
Yes,
so.
In this paper, the region is defined by a cohort of provinces. So much bigger than just one province like Zhejiang.
So there's three regions that you have in your model, right?
Yeah,
so there's the kind of east coast, then there's the central, and then there's the western. Is that?
Yes, right? Yes.
So maybe give our listeners an idea of the differences between those regions, because I think many people don't have a full understanding of that.
I think we can just skip the middle one, the central one. You can just compare the western with the eastern coastal. I think the significant difference is that the development level is quite different, right? We have the huge gap between the GDP per capita. We have, something like that. So the reason why we just chose three regions instead of more than 30 provinces is that this is convenient for modeling. As we use a dynamic model, this is already complicated. And if we introduce two more heterogeneous agents, and yes, it's difficult to tell the story, and it's unnecessary, as we have already explain the story clearly.
Absolutely. I just out of curiosity, so a place like Shanghai, which is it comprises a kind of special economic region unto itself, right? Was that included in the East Coast?
Yes.
Okay.
Definitely.
So there are these huge economic powerhouses that are in this area.
Yes.
And then you compare it to the Western provinces.
Yes, we believe there's some common factor in the region of we see the cohorts of provinces in one region, like in Shanghai, Beijing, the local government all have the surplus, fiscal surplus, not the fiscal deficits, and they all have the higher per capita GDP. They have the common factor as one representative region.
I find that really interesting, the way that people often don't realize that level of difference within China, I feel. Mm-hmm. They talk about China as a whole, but actually we're talking about some very specific sort of centers of generating, of wealth generation mm-hmm. And power at the mm-hmm. same time. And I feel that that's almost kind of forgotten when people actually talk about China, simply because they don't understand how vast and complicated it is.
Well, that's right. And these different regions can grow at different rates, potentially, mm-hmm. have different trading patterns. Mm. There are all these extra and growth patterns. So essentially, your article is looking at the trade-off between growth and equity, right? So yes. can you maybe summarize what you found in terms of the China model?
Mm-hmm. Compared with the related literature, and someone just talk about the regional inequality, someone talk about the aggregate growth, someone talk about the fiscal pressure or deficit, but we put all of this into one dynamic model, and then we find some interesting thing. The first one is that, you know, in the central government, that definitely has, I mean, the transfer rule, but this transfer rule is not published to us. So we have to estimate this transfer rule. When we estimate this transfer rule, we found that, okay, and the central government prefers to transfer more to the Western. So that is the basic rule. Mm. And after this rule, we find that, okay, now we indeed have a reduction in the regional inequality. Yeah, that is a success. Mm. Mm-hmm. But with cost of aggregate growth, mm-hmm. uh-huh, that means there is a trade-off for the central government. So sometimes you can do the rebalance plan, but you have to sacrifice something else. That is the GDP. Yeah, this is the important finding. So we want to remind the central government to notice this trade-off. The second contribution, the finding, is that we propose a suggestion. The suggestion is that if they adjust the transfer rule, we estimated the transfer rule in reality. For example, they just focus on the per capita GDP gap relevant to the average in the whole country, and then do not just show the preference, like too much biased towards the Western. And then we may have a free lunch. That means, yeah, we can reduce the inequality and without too much cost of growth and even no cost of growth. So that this is the second finding, and I think it's a useful suggestion for the central government.
Now, the two mechanisms that you list out in this paper as being the major ones by the central government are these transfer payments, but also the rebates, right?
Yeah.
And so how do these work? And what did you find in terms of the relative value of these things?
And actually, we can't call rebate policy just like rewarding a good performance child in your class and a student in class. And so the other one, the other type, we call it a general transfer or the equalization transfer. Mm. And that means you will reward the bad performance students in your class, you know.
I'm not sure that metaphor is going to hold all economists.
So the question is, the central government actually reward both simultaneously, but I think now the balance has been broken down. At the beginning of the 1994 reform, they are equivalent, but after 10 years or the 20 years, you can see now that rewarding the good performance students, now I think the amount is smaller and smaller. Yes.
Mm. Yeah. And is there an underlying ideology behind that you're aware of? Because it seems to me, I remember people saying, business folk that I'm friends with, that the initial growth idea was that, okay, we're going to let a lot of people get very rich, and we'll let these regions get rich in order to eventually equalize the kind of wealth. Mm. And I, you know, not being Chinese, I'm not I can't cite the documents or things like that. Mm. But are you aware of deliberate policy along this line?
I think, yes. I think someone should have the social responsibility, especially for the very rich, the wealthy people, or the wealthy performance province. They could help the poor. Mm. But I think the extent is our awareness. I think now the transfer, or we say the relative proportion of rewarding the bad performance students is too much.
Okay.
So, so I think that is a problem because you do not know why they performed, I think, not good, right? Mm-hmm. Not well.
Or so, less well.
Yeah,
right?
less well. You know. So you should first dig the reason behind that. Mm-hmm. If you do not know the reason, now I think we don't have the consensus on the why we have the gap now. But if you do not know the reason, and then you just give the money to bad performance or less well performance, mm-hmm. sorry.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to play semantic games, but it's just to...
Yes, sure, you cannot guarantee how they will use this money. Mm-hmm. I mean, the transferees,
I found that very interesting, the transferal, and you almost seem to be warning about the potential of what happens if this is unchecked, mm-hmm. in a sense. And a lot of it felt like it was motivated by the fact that the central government is very aware of problems that are caused by inequality, you know, and the social instability that can result, mm-hmm. if you don't have equality across a country. And we see that obviously in other places in the world too.
Yeah.
And that was actually building into my next question, which is that a lot of what you're talking about here is obviously China specific and you're studying China. But how much of this is specific to China and how much of it is unique and how much of it actually do we see elsewhere in the world as regards this model?
Yeah, I think we just give an example for vast country, and for many other countries like Canada, but a little bit empathy.
we do have transfer payments, and that has been
all
contentious.
All the United States, yeah. The central government should firstly think the role it will play, right? Mm. And do you want to play as a parent, powerful parent, or just as a server? And the second one is that you should design a well transfer system, And I think the one important perspective from our paper is that, yes, if you just, you can still keep transferring to the less well, less well performed performance, but you need to consider the cost and just cautiously design this policy. And maybe you can have a free lunch.
Everyone wants a free lunch.
Oh, yeah.
So one thing that I was really interested in is propensity of these more regional governments to impose a kind of non-tax fee.
Oh, yeah.
And the effect that can actually have on local entrepreneurship and the like. So maybe you could say something about the dangers of the non-centralized performance at times.
Okay. I just want to start with the history of the fiscal reform.
Please.
You know, before the reform and opening up policy in 1978, in China, actually, the Chinese government implemented a fiscal policy called It in a Big Pot. So this fiscal policy is completely centralized. The central government has almost all the revenue, the tax revenues are the fiscal revenues, and then share this to the local government. And so the local government lost the efficiency, right? And so this incentives to stimulate the GDP. And after that, the important policy, the reform and opening up policy, we just turn to the other extreme, right?
What's the metaphor for that? So you have all eating out of the same pot, and then you each get your separate dish?
Yes, in the separate dish, in the separate kitchen. So that means completely decentralized. So we call it the market reform or something else, right? So in that case, the local government has the authority to collect the tax revenues or fiscal revenues, but they also take the spending obligations, right? The obligations are also allocated to the local government, like you need to build the schools to develop education, healthcare, or something else.
Right. And am I correct in thinking that's a formula for making sure that the rich get richer and the poor get poorer? Or
just to give you the incentives to develop your economy.
Okay.
So give you authority to collect money, to spend money. So, but the thing is that I think now the thing changed after 1994. Why 1990s? You know, I think that he has a political background. The Soviet Union broke down, so China was put in front of the represents of the socialist country. Right? So maybe compete with the US or some other country. So the central government need to gather more money. So the third step is that I call it anti-decentralization. So it's not centralization, just like the case before 1978, but just a little bit go back towards the centralization.
Okay, fair enough.
From the decentralization, complete decentralization, it's a moderate get back to
Okay.
So, but the revenue is centralized slightly to the central government, but the spending obligation still on the local governments.
Okay, so that's interesting. So is this for things like infrastructure projects?
Right. Yeah, so that means, suppose that as a household, if your spending is stable, but your revenue goes down, what happens? You will have a deficit. You have to borrow. Right. So I think this is one important reason for now the increase in deficits for the local government. So local government will have this fiscal pressure, right? That is the basic economic background for this paper, right? And if you have the fiscal pressure, what can you do to fill this gap? You have to find some funding or money to finance your stable spending, right? As you have the spending obligations, right? So where to find this money? Non-tax revenue is local government's important tool, as well as land policy. But you know, in China, someone will argue the land policy, land fiscal policy or land policy. But in China, the money you sell, your money you get by selling the land or the use rights of the land, you have to use it specifically in some specific purpose, not just freely use this. But the non-tax fee, you can freely use the non-tax fee revenues. So this is our focus.
But yeah, I found that very interesting, this idea that you can just put a fee on things, collect that money, and it belongs to the region. But that this, you've said that it basically dampens the entrepreneurship because
That was my next question.
This is a private sector. I think this is, if the non-tax fee that you have is definitely is harmful to the private sector,
so
especially
is it harmful to entrepreneurism within China? Because I was interested in that part of your paper where you talked about whether or not entrepreneurs are put in a good position to generate and to manage innovation. A lot of our students, of course, go on to become entrepreneurs and start their own companies in that way too. And also entrepreneurship is a concept that outside China is not often associated with China, where of course I see this as a sort of center of entrepreneurship in that way. So can you talk a little bit about how this difference between regional and sort of national taxation affects entrepreneurship per se?
Mm-hmm. Regardless of the regional difference, I think it's clear that the non-tax fees can affect the entrepreneurship. If we know the components of the non-tax fees, one important thing is a penalty.
Mm.
You know, just the penalty fees. Look at now in China, and the central government had now realized in the recent years, I think the serious situation is that some local government just use the penalty to finance the spending. So this is one of the non-tax
fees. Can you just give an example of a penalty fee for listeners?
Like if you, for example, the air pollution or some pollution, right. Or some facilities, you do not just buy some facilities. Maybe you will be charged for some reason, but the reason, you know, in some special time,
might
not
be arbitrary.
Sometimes it's arbitrary.
I was really curious about this. I was reading through, all of this depends on the notion that this is all the above board economy. And I was just kind of, when I was reading through, redistribution, softening the local government budget constraints and kind of rewards failures and poor resource management and corruption among local officials, this type of idea. I recently had read something about India having a wholly shadow economy in many cases. So a lot of people don't even live on a kind of taxation principle or that. Is that a concern here? Because I know there's been massive reforms and huge amount of anti-corruption activity here in China over the last 20 years. How successful has that been? And do we know if there's a shadow economy going on?
I love your term there, the above board economy. That's great.
I don't know if it's a real economic term.
It is now.
Yeah, I'm not sure the situation of the anti-corruption, but all the phrase you mentioned, the shadow economy. Mm. But I do know something about the shadow banks. Some economic department or sector, shadow banks. So as I know, and we find some evidence that, so not in this paper, but other studies, that shadow banks can just provide some funding to the private sector as well as to the public sector. Or state-owned company or the local government. If the local government has the fiscal pressure, then they may just borrow from the shadow bank.
Okay, interesting.
Shadow bank, yeah. Mm. So this shadow bank will be the lending or be crowd out from lending to the private sector. So I think it is also harmful to the private sector as well.
I always get texts on my phone asking me to borrow money. And as a non-entrepreneur, I'm not tempted.
Just now I mentioned the non-tax fees, but I think I missed one important thing. It's not just a penalty. Some formal non-tax fees are allowed. Yes, like in China, we have the we call it city construction fees, additional fees, and education additional fees.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. These fees are just like tax, but not collected by the central bank and share, but totally collected by local governments. And how much they will tax or will charge, or totally depend on local governments. So
it's really interesting to me because, I agree with you. They're kind of a non-tax tax or a service fee that's going towards something ostensibly particular. There was another point in the paper that I thought was really interesting, and it's when we're talking about the population inflow into certain areas and some really interesting points, because I didn't realize this, that in most cases, it's not a regional inflow, but rather a flow throughout a region, which I think is pretty interesting. But when you do have an inflow, And those, because the statement made here was following Sun et al., mm-hmm, that the effect of population inflow on regional economic growth is insignificant. Mm-hmm. And I'm not doubting that. I was just a bit surprised by that, because...
That was my next question, actually. Oh, okay. Yeah, you've been jumping ahead of me.
I am excited about this.
I know. I'm feeling the energy here, all right? I didn't think you got so excited about taxation, Derek.
And inflow and migration, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
May I ask my question first?
May I?
Does... inflow into a region not construct generally a kind of infrastructure which actually would have an impact on regional growth, or or is this insignificance of a different sort?
In our model, we simplify the population immigration, and due to some current evidence on that, the findings or the convenience for the modeling. But I think even if we have the immigration, I think the story will not, the fundamental findings will not be broken. And this is because we can just look at educational spending, all right, by the local government, like in the Gansu province or any western province. And when the local government spends a lot of money on local education, like building the schools, and they just need to make all the children and the young people get well educated, and then this well trained or well educated people sometimes will flow out to the coastal.
To clarify here, when we refer to immigration, we're talking to intra-regional immigration, aren't we? We're not talking about sort of immigration from
outside.
That is the evidence. The evidence shows that the immigration just between provinces within the maybe within the region, but just within the province, not just cross provinces. Mm. But if we consider the cross-regional, cross-province immigration, just like the example I give, like the Gansu, the well-trained people, well-educated people flow out to the coastal, and what will happen? And then we say that some local spending is useless.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? You've invested in outflow.
So the local government, I think the local government will have some other fiscal pressure, as the you spend the money but you do not get the revenues, so still have the fiscal pressure.
So you say that a heavy emphasis on labor mobility across regions seems quite misplaced as an explanation for China's growth and regional inequality. Why has that been such a heavy explanation? Why have people jumped to using labor mobility as an explanation for China's growth if you say it's not actually?
I think, I guess their motivations, their human capital, or the cost of the hiring labor. As if you have the labor mobility, maybe you have the excess supply of labor, then the demands, and then for the coastal city, coastal province, they may have to always see the allocation resource.
There's also constraints on this, right? So the hukou system, for example, is meant to presumably keep people in children in the region where they
hukou
grow.
It's still a barrier now in China, but I think it's just for the rural and between the rural and the urban. But if you look at if you look at urban citizens, and the hukou is not a barrier.
Okay.
Just like me, I'm born in Shandong province, north province, but now I'm working in Wuhan, a different province, far away from my hometown. So as an urban citizen, the hukou is not a problem. But for the rural one.
Yeah, so for migrant workers that are laborers, I think it's more of a barrier, right? Because they tend to be from more rural areas.
Yeah, yes. Yes, but the difference is that generally, if we look at the statistics, you can find the educational level for the urban citizens and the rural citizens are quite different, mm-hmm. right? We cannot deny this gap. So just to consider the well-trained or the well-educated, I think the hooker is not the barrier. Mm-hmm. Yes, but for some manufacturing industry, hooker, I think, is... Awesome.
And the building industry. So if you're putting in infrastructure, roads and buildings, I suspect a lot of those laborers would. And just for the listeners who might not know, the hukou system is people go to school in the area where they're born, right? Mm-hmm. Just to clarify.
The hukou system is just about the individual, also about the family. The family is just a big problem behind immigration.
Labor
flow out, and then the family, the parents, and have to move together to take care of his children, and the children as well.
I asked you at the beginning of this interview about how unique a lot of these findings are to China and how kind of we find sort of similar things or dissimilar things in different countries around the world. One reason I actually asked you that was because I'm very interested in the group of collaborators here because you have a number of co-authors or three other co-authors. So there were four of you together. And you are actually the only Chinese author within that. So I was quite interested as to how did this come about? How did you find this very international group who are all so interested in the workings, the taxation workings of China?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. In education now, we encourage diverse. Yeah, we have the diverse authors from the Britain, from China. Yes, and actually, I have the good relationship between with the Kent Matthew. He's a professor at the business school, and Lucy. We have a good friendship for quite a long time, and she's my PhD supervisor's daughter.
That's very good. Yeah,
I think this is important reason to make this team. So we have many times to chat and to talk about the research ideas. So yes, we make this team, and David provides some technical methods, approaches. Yeah.
That's excellent. I think it's important for our listeners to realize that a lot of times building a supportive and diverse research team is key to getting some good work done.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's very much a strength in your research.
Yeah, I don't think I'm so good to be the single author.
Join the club.
Everything. Yes. So we just share. We just allocate the different works. So for example, I contribute modeling, contribute some ideas, and Lucy contributed some ideas and writing. And I can't give us many useful, insightful comments, and David is technical production.
Great. One of the questions we always ask, in fact, is since this article has come out, and I realize it's a fairly recent article, but has there been any criticism of it? Have you had any responses to it that might make you pause to think?
Yes. I think we have got some comments, some feedback, positive or negative. This paper just published this year, but I think it has been cited twice or three times. It's less than 1 year, and someone may support our findings, but someone may argue just like why just talk about the within region. Right, or within country, but not to the deeper level, like within the province, like in Zhejiang, we have we have many transfers. So yes, I think in the that is a future work. We'll leave some a lot of work in the future.
Well, that's always our next question as well.
Because you mentioned before that You feel that some of the findings are quite significant to the way that China is organized and the way that the government does organize its fiscal policy here. So my next question then is, what do you hope to achieve from this paper? What do you hope to achieve from the future? Are you hoping that the central government will notice this and take it on board in this way?
Yes, definitely. As a researcher, if we provide some, I think, interesting suggestion, and we think the suggestion is practical, we hope the policymakers will notice this. And for example, they can adjust or pay more attention on the transfer formula. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the section 6 or the last two sections in our paper, we did some counterfactual analysis, simulation analysis, to see if we use a little bit different transfer formula, what will happen.
Mm.
So we just show the potential results for that reform. Not, I think it's not reform, even reform, just some adjustment.
Sure.
The way you phrase it is to get more bang for your buck, right? So tweaks and how to maximize the system.
Yes. And so I'm also thinking about another interesting thing. I think is related to this paper is that the conflict between the targets of different level of governments, like the central government and the local government. For the central government in China, I believe that, and the targeting is a very long one. Maybe the central government may make a 100-year plan. Mm-hmm. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And yes. So the objective for the central government may be the social welfare, or you see the common prosperity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. But for the local government, I think the story is a little bit different. They prefer efficiency more than the equality.
Ooh, that's an interesting difference.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We call it short living government. For the central government is long living. Yeah. The government is always there, but the governor, will leave maybe after 5 years or 10 years. It's just to another province.
Mm-hmm.
So for the local government, I think the target is a short one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not slow. Yeah. So there's a conflict between the targeting of the central government and local governments. So
government, taxes, death. Those are all assured in this model.
On that happy note, a final question for you then. What are your plans for the future? What can we see from you coming out of your research in the future? Do you have any immediate plans?
Yeah, the immediate plan, yes. What I'm thinking now, what I'm doing is about the income taxation now. I just gave a speech on that topic yesterday about the age-dependent income taxation, as I noticed that the age discrimination or the cohort effect across different generations in China is, and I think the phenomenon is serious. And yes, so what I'm doing now is that topic, but still the transfer, but the transfer to individuals, not to the government.
Mm-hmm.
And in the future about this, I think this direction, my design is that we can consider two different ways to develop this, this paper. The one way is about the types of the transfer. You know, in China, in this paper, we focus on two types, the general and the rebates. Actually, we still have another one. It calls the earmarked grant transfer, earmarked grant. That means, for example, if you are Darren, you need money. As a central government, I will ask, what do you want to spend? What do you want to buy? So if you want to buy this, okay, I, as a central government, I buy this for you.
Oh, thank you.
I do not just give you money and let you spend. Maybe you do not buy the thing you told me. You maybe just buy a beer. Okay. Right? So I do not directly
that was my
give
plan
you
anyway.
I just do not give you money directly.
Yeah.
Oh, I give you money, but I just send someone to monitor you how you spend this money. Yes. But just give you the money freely. So thank you.
thank you for explaining that so well through the use of Derek.
I would earmark it towards certain things for
sure. Well, I understand that your presentation was very successful here and that you had a full house and everybody enjoyed that very much. And I also know that you're a regular at UNNC. I think you said this is your third time to visit our campus.
But so this is my first time to take an interview. A little bit nervous, but
thank you very much. I learned a lot from it.
Absolutely.
I appreciate
I know
more
about the inner workings of the country I live in.
Yeah.
Really, I feel.
Quite important.
Yeah. Well, I do hope that on your next trip here, you will drop by the studio and come and tell us about your next publication, because I have no doubt it will be successful. And I know you have much more coming out. So thank you very much. I also wish
next the visit here and so also expect the promotion. The improvement in my
fantastic. Thank you very much for spending the time with us, Xiaolang.
Thank you.
bye for now.
Okay.
With 110 academic staff from 22 countries and regions, the Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is committed to delivering world-class teaching and research, with a growing focus on interdisciplinary projects. Our faculty includes the School of Economics, the School of Education and English, the School of International Communications, and the School of International Studies, as well as the Language Center.
We are committed to internationally renowned and excellent research in a thriving transdisciplinary environment of outstanding individual and collective research. Our faculty is home to a number of groundbreaking projects, including but not limited to digital heritage, game cultures, the historical and contemporary Silk Roads, health economics, cognitive neuroscience of language, and gender studies.
The Faculty of Humanities and Social Science is also proud to host a high percentage of international staff who bring expertise to areas such as history, politics, journalism, media and film studies, education, English, micro and macroeconomics, and more, as well as a wealth of experience from international universities.
We strive to offer an education and student experience reflecting the most up-to-date knowledge and achieve this through the close integration of teaching and research. Our research-led teaching places cutting-edge knowledge at the center of our curriculum, while our academic staff actively engage our students in their ongoing research activities.